accession number 18676, Reel 5.
Righto, Sonny. March Sergeant Turton. So, see you last. And he says, you hired this boat, he says, for tours, is that right, Sergeant Turton? So I said, yes. He says, and you were more or less the man who knew to handle boats. So I said, yes, sir. He says, and did you expect to get back by 4 o'clock? Oh, yes, he said, yes. He says, we'd only hired the boat for 2 hours. He says, yes, naturally, we expected to be back. And he explained, like I'd explained, about this wind getting up and we couldn't beat our way back. So, the last question was that Foster asked Jack. He says, and you really expected to get back by 4 o'clock? He said, oh, yes, sir. He says, that's all we'd paid for the boat. He said, we'd hired it before, just for the 2 hours, and we'd all have got back. He says, we're quarter of an hour to spare. Right, so he dismissed Jack like, and he went out. And then they brought this other charge in about sailing on neutral waters. So I said, well, I says, you can't have me for sailing on neutral waters, sir. I said, at least if you do, I said, you're going to have to charge the whole unit. He said, what for? I said, because we're in a neutral country. I said, Egypt's neutral. So I looked at the Sergeant Major. And sailing on neutral waters, case dismissed. And then he says, and you fully expected to be back by 4 o'clock, giving you 2 hours to get back to camp and get into uniform and take your parade at 6 o'clock. I says, yes, sir. Right, case dismissed. Well, if you'd have seen Sergeant, Staff Sergeant Ball's face, wasn't in it. We were moving from Geneva towards the end of November, and we were going to Alexandria. And just then, Les Gapper, Sergeant Gapper, one of the dispensers, was taken sick, and he was taken into 19th General Hospital, which was the base hospital in the canal zone, up by the Bitter Lake between Geneva and Ismailia. So we set off by train, and they were having a go slow with the Egyptian railways. Again, getting at the army, and also trying to up the prices for the transporting of troops by train. Well, normally it was about a 3 hour journey from Geneva to Alexandria by train, and it took us 36 hours. We were stopping and starting, and I remember the one thing that sticks out in my mind. The seats were wooden slatted, and by God, they were hard after 5 or 6 hours. And the other thing was when we stopped, running up to engine with Dixies with dry tea in the bottom and getting the engine driver to put a boiling water out of boiler at engine in this Dixie to make us tea, because we'd taken no provisions for food on the train. But luckily we were able to get at the rations that were in the first coach. Anyway, we got to Alexandria, and we were stationed with number 8 General Hospital, and they had taken over the Italian embassy. It was a big place, and part of it was sealed off. There was a certain rooms and doors that were sealed off, and the seals had the Swiss embassy wax seals on the doors, because they were being caretakers for the Italian government while it was at a state of war with us. Anyway, we were in tents on the tennis courts, and we settled in. They gave us 24 hours more or less to settle in. Then we went to work with H. General Hospital. The nursing orderlies onto the wards, cooks into cookhouse, and quartermaster staff into quartermaster staff. Everything to give us experience, you see. Well, it was a wonderful billet. And the food were, out of this world compared with what we'd been getting. Even the lads' food was 10 times better than what we'd been used to. Well, of course, we joined the sergeant's mess. Now, they have about, 8th General had about 60 to 70 in their mess, whereas we only had 10. And the food was fabulous. It was Dupont cooks, Dupont waiters, the lot. And we spent Christmas there. Just before Christmas, one night about 7 o'clock, this lone sergeant came in, and it was Tom King, Sergeant Tom King, dispenser being posted to us, straight from base camp, and he got off the boat about 3 or 4 days previously, and he'd been sent to replace Gapper. Now, I had a big friend of Tom King, he was about 10 years older than us. I'm a very nice man, I got on really well with him, and we became firm friends during his stay with us, and we kept that friendship up right up to last year, 92, when he died, and he died at the Easter. Kept it up by correspondence, writing. Met him once at Scarborough after the war. He turned up one night, and he'd had a nervous breakdown, and his doctor had ordered him away from the business because he had a chemist shop in Blackpool. He'd come to Scarborough thinking he could just, get accommodation, but it was August bank holiday. Well, there wasn't a place to be got anyway. And he called to see us on his way back. He was going to go back to Blackpool. I said, no, you're not. I said, you'll stop here. But as I say, that's coming on to another story. We made very good friends. We had a nice Christmas, and of course every other night practically you could get into Alexandria because you were only on duty every other night. And I was put with a Staff Sergeant Klitovsky. He was a regular army soldier. He was of Russian descent. His people had emigrated to England, I think, just after the revolution or something like that, and he was naturalised English, born in England, but he was definitely of Russian features, the flattish looking features, and his name was Klitovsky, and I was with him as wardmaster, and we kept quite busy there in that job. You were responsible for everything on the wards. The sisters did the nursing and the orderlies, but you were responsible for keeping up all the admissions, discharges, ward transfers, arranging transport to operating theatres, x-rays and all this, bed states, all the army forms that had to go off every week and every day. If you had seriously ill or dangerously ill patients, a report had to go off every 24 hours to GHQ Cairo, giving the state of the patients and all that. And it was really busy. You didn't have a minute to spare. Anyway, as I say, we had a wonderful Christmas there. And then, come January, right, we're moving out, we're going up, as we call it, the blue. This photograph is of the Fleet Club in Alexandria. It was a tremendously big place, and it was open to all branches of the service, Army, Navy and Air Force. And apart from the usual, what can you say, facilities for a club, there was also shops. Local traders had shops there where you could buy stuff and arrange for it to be sent home, etc. I bought a handbag for Alma and arranged for it to be sent home. And, oh yes, very good, buy it here, we get it home by the Navy. So, they get it very quick. They did. It took over 9 months to arrive, and we thought it had been lost, and in the meantime, when it was hadn't arrived after 6 months, I bought her another one and sent it off. So she got two. But as I say, it was a nice place. You could go in there and have a meal. There was recreation facilities, billiard room and such like. It was a real good club, was that. It was peacetime. And it was a first-class club, but of course, it had to be spoiled about 4 months into 1941. The Australians started a brawl in there, and that was it. All army personnel were barred from there afterwards. This is the Britannia Club in Alexandria. It wasn't as well patronised as the Fleet Club. Partly because you couldn't get any beer. It was a dry club. But it was a nice place to go, that you could have a quiet sit down and a read. And you could also get light refreshments like tea and toast and such like. This is just a street scene in Alexandria. It was taken during one of the very quiet moments. There were few and far between. I don't think I ever remember seeing a street so empty as it was when I took this photograph. As I say, come the beginning of January 1941, we were shipped out of Alexandria by cattle boat to Siloam, and from Siloam we moved to Bardia, where we took over an Italian tented general hospital. This is Corporal Cooper on an Italian motorbike that they'd managed to get going, and he used to spend his spare time herring about on this motorbike. I remember once having a pillion ride with him, and the Italians had more or less outlined the perimeter of the camp with stones, and as we're coming into camp he drove between two of these stoves, and my feet on the pillion rest were pointing downwards, and they caught the stones that he drove in between. God, I thought he'd broke my legs. While we're at Bardia, the 9th Australian General Hospital was shipwrecked, and we got them in and we had them for about 4 days, and of course, whereas we were only about 100 strong, they had 400 odd. It was quite a job to accommodate him and feed him, but we did, we made the best of it. And when they left us about 5 days later, The CO and Sergeant Major, oh, thank you for your hospitality and all this. And if ever you're near us, get in touch and we'll give you a night out to repay you for your hospitality. Anyway, I'll tell you how they repaid the hospitality later. The other thing I remember about Bardia was fleas, and it was lifting with them. And you couldn't get rid of them. No matter what you did, you couldn't get rid of them. We used to spray our blankets with paraffin, with flip guns, and then hang them out, and it didn't make any difference. They were still there again at night. Anyway, this is Corporal Cooper, Cooper on his high-tie bike. This is Private Ives of the Army Dental Corps at Bardia. This is a captured dental unit that we had. And as I said earlier at Geneva, these three dental corps chaps used to be very good at producing comic sketches when we had concerts. And we used to think it was this chap Ives who was the brains behind it. But later on it proved that it was One Stripe Cleary who was the brains. Anyway, while we were at Bardia, we were collecting up captured equipment. And while we were there, we sent over 10 three-ton lorry loads of surgical equipment, etc., back to base. We never used a single bandage or anything out of our own stores the whole of that push. Everything we used was captured. And there was literally thousands and thousands of tons worth of equipment just abandoned. Lorries. As I say, this was a dental unit. Motorbikes. Literally, you could pick up rifles and machine guns anywhere you liked over the battlefield. They'd just left the lot. Anyway, while we were there, we sorted ourselves out. We became quite an efficient unit, although I say it myself. And then from there, we moved to Derna. Derna was a village on the coast in Libya, up past Tobruk. What would it be, 40 or 50 miles past Tobruk, and it was at the bottom of an escarpment. The coastal road went down this steep escarpment, series of sharp hairpin bends, literally cut into the cliff face. I will say this, the Italians were past masters at building roads. And out at the other end, again, there was another escarpment, but it wasn't quite as high as the one coming from Tobruk. It was more or less untouched, was Derna, when we got there, 1941. And I took these photographs while we were there. One thing I remember about Derna was the water. It was the nicest water we'd tasted since leaving England. It was completely neutral, crystal clear and cold. This is just a general view in Derna. This is another view on the approach road to the centre of Derna, taken in 1941. This is some of the local inhabitants of Derna, taken in the marketplace. There were Senussis at Derna. They were Mohammedans, but of the Senussi tribe. Here are some more of the inhabitants at the edge of the marketplace in Derna in 1941. This is the mosque at Derna. And you'll notice the crescent right on the top of the pinnacle of the mosque. That was to denote that it was the Senussi tribe. This is the marketplace at Derna, and as you can see, things were practically normal. There'd been practically no damage done at all to Derna, and life was going on as near normal as what it was possible under the circumstances. Just further along through here was a photographer's shop where I got these photographs developed and printed. And I'll tell you the tale of that in a few moments. This is another couple of the local inhabitants at Derna in 1941. This is a dried up riverbed at Derna, 1941. As I say, we took over the hospital at the bottom of the escarpment. It was the Hospital Princess Piedmont. And this is Sergeant Bloomfield and Sergeant Major Williams holding the hospital shield. This is Sergeant Joe Smith in the little garden of the sergeant's mess. We took over the nuns' quarters for a sleeping accommodation and the sergeant's mess, because the hospital had been run by Roman Catholic sisters. This is the grotto in the little garden near the sergeant's mess at the Hospital Princess Piedmont. The RC seems to go in for this type of grotto a lot, because you see them even in England on practically the same design entirely as what this one is. Oh, they also had a peacock that used to strut around the grounds. Anything about that, it's raucous cry. Used to be very annoying at times. This is me at Derna, 1941, after we'd been bathing down in the bay. This is Sergeant Joe Smith, our fit addict. This was when he'd been bathing down at the beach, down in the bay at Derna, 1941. This is Sergeant Wilkinson and myself having a bathe at Derna, 1941. This is me at Derna again, 1941. This is me and Sergeant Wilkinson after we've been having a dip at Derna, 1941. This is the view from the cove where we used to go bathing, looking towards Derna, with the breakwater in the foreground, middle foreground. This is a view looking towards the tiny harbour at Derna. And as you'll notice, there's one or two of the ships are sunk. I think they were Italian that we'd sunk. This is some of the lads at Derna outside the billet. I'm afraid it's slightly out of focus And the only one I can say with any certainty of who it is the second from the left, and that's Norman Sheldon. The others, I'm afraid it's too blurred for me to make out. This is myself in the dress uniform at Derna in 1941. I carried that uniform all the way through the Middle East or had it in store at Thomas Cook's in Cairo, and I think this was the only time I put it on. The reason I got it was in England before we came abroad. According to the CO, we were going to Kenya, and anybody who had dress uniforms were advised to take them with them, as we should do quite a bit of entertaining. My God, we did some entertaining. Right, well, that was the last of the photographs that I was taken in the first push. Now, the army always had fancy names for these offensives and such like, but to the ordinary lads, it was Wavell's push, Auchinleck's push, and Montgomery's push, the three pushes. Anyway, I said I would tell you about those photographs. The photographs starting where we have Billy Bloomfield and the Sergeant Major holding the Princess Piedmont shield at Derna until the last one of me in my dress uniform. I took that film on the Monday to the little photography shop that I told you was just off the marketplace, and I put it in for developing and printing, and they gave me this scribbled receipt for it in Arabic. That was on the Monday. On the Tuesday, troops started coming back through Derna from the front and just driving straight through. Anyway, we found out later in the day from the CO that the Africa Corps had landed and were in action, and that they were pushing us back. Our forward troops were up past Benghazi at this time. I think it was a place called Alagaela. That was the furthest we got. That was the real front line troops. That was where they'd got to, chasing the ITIs and so on, when they came in contact with the Africa Corps. And they definitely had superior armaments, etc., tanks, than what we had. And everybody started falling back. On Tuesday and Wednesday, it was nose to tail coming through Derna. And of course the escarpments held them up, because it was a slow process getting up these escarpments. They were all hairpin bends. Thursday it started slackening off a bit. And I don't think I mentioned that while we were at Bardia, we got a new CO. Colonel Foster was recalled to base and promoted to full colonel and to take charge of a general hospital in the base. And Major Keller fancied his chances of becoming CO. However, much to his dismay, after being a week as not acting CO but the senior officer in the unit, this Lieutenant Colonel Dowland arrived. Now, Colonel Foster had been what you could call a gentleman.